Divine Glimpses by Vishnu. The author of this article is one of the senior most disciples of Bhagavan, who also enjoyed special privileges. He was one of the few who helped Bhagavan in his work in the kitchen described elsewhere in this issue. He was also one of the few chosen to witness the drawing up and the signing of the will by which Bhagavan left the management of the ashram to his collateral descendants, that is, to the family of his brother, Naranjananda Swami. It even happened on occasion that Bhagavan postponed some small function when his professional work called him away and held it only after his return. When he first went to Bhagavan as a young man, he was a modernist and free thinker. He told the two friends who took him that he would not bow down to him. He bowed down, all right, and it was he who stayed and they who left. We are grateful to him for giving a few items from his vast fund of reminiscences. Bhagavan is God himself. And in saying this, I do not refer to any of the personal gods of any religion, but to the universal principle of pure consciousness. I dislike to compare him with any past personage, for there is no meaning in comparing incarnations of that one principle which has no second. But yet, for our understanding, if at all we want to compare, it can only be with Christ or Buddha. I never forgot, whenever I was talking with him or sitting in his presence, that here was God sitting and talking. It is our greatest fortune that the Supreme Consciousness, appearing in the garb of a human body, graciously undertook to come down to our level of understanding and bore the tremendous task of imparting to us the truth of Atma Vidya. Such a thought always made me understand him and his talks better and more clearly. Once a few very learned Sanskrit scholars were sitting in the old hall discussing portions of the Upanishads and other scriptural texts with Bhagavan. Bhagavan was giving them proper explanations, and it was a sight to remember and adore. At the same time, I felt genuinely in my heart, oh, how great these people are, and how fortunate they are to be so learned, to have such deep understanding, and be able to discuss with our Bhagavan. Compared with them, what am I? A zero in scriptural learning. I felt miserable. After the pundits had taken leave, Bhagavan turned to me and said, "What?" looking into my eyes and studying my thoughts. Then, without even giving me an opportunity to explain, he continued, "This is only the husk. All this book learning and capacity to repeat the scripture by memory is absolutely no use. To know the truth, you need not undergo all this torture of learning. Not by reading do you get the truth. Be quiet. That is truth. Be still. That is God." Then, very graciously, he turned to me again, and there was an immediate change in his tone and attitude. He asked me, "Do you shave yourself?" Bewildered by this sudden change, I answered, trembling, "Yes, I do shave myself." "Ah, for shaving you use a mirror, don't you? You look into the mirror and then shave your face. You don't shave the image in the mirror." Similarly, all the scriptures are meant only to show you the way to realization. They are meant for practice and attainment. Mere book learning and discussions are comparable to a man shaving the image in the mirror. From that day onwards, the sense of inferiority that I had been feeling vanished once and for all. One more assurance from Bhagavan, which also he gave as a personal instruction, is of absolute value for me and in my sadhana. I cried to him that I knew nothing about Vedanta, nor could I practice austerity, being a householder. So I prayed to him to help me by showing the reality or the way to it. I also frankly admitted that Bhagavan's own method of self-inquiry is too hard for me. He then graciously said, "You know Uladu Narapadu, truth in 40 verses. It imparts pure truth, deals with it, and explains it. Go on reading it, verse by verse. The word of the verses will in course of time vanish, and pure truth, Sat, alone, will shine. Like the snake relinquishing its skin and coming out shining." So, this is my sadhana. One day, I was sitting near Bhagavan's couch, and I felt puzzled by the ancient teaching that everything that appears in the world is Maya or illusion. I wondered how it could be. When I saw Bhagavan, the couch on which he sat, the barrier separating me from Bhagavan and myself, how could all these be false? I asked Bhagavan, explaining my doubt. "Bhagavan, can all of us be unreal and non-existent? Please enlighten me." Bhagavan laughed and asked me whether I had any dream the previous night. I replied that I saw several people lying asleep. He said, "Suppose now I ask you to go and wake all those people in the dream and tell them they are not real. How absurd would it be? That is how it is to me. There is nothing but the dreamer. So where does the question of dream people, real or unreal, arise? Still more of waking them up and telling them that they are not real. We are all unreal. Why do you doubt it? This alone is real, or that alone is real." After this explanation, I never had any doubt about the unreality of the objective world. I constantly feel the reality in their unreal nature. On another occasion, he said, "Everything is unreal, like dream objects. However, at a certain stage, there exists truth, reality, and world, the unreality. And a jnani's job is to awaken the ignorant to the fact that what they see and feel is unreal, and that the reality is their own being. This can be compared to an elephant dreaming of a lion and suddenly waking up and finding that the lion is unreal, and that itself alone is real. The elephant is the jiva or individual. The dream is the unreal world, and the lion, the jnani or guru. The guru is a link between the unreal and the real." On another occasion, he said, "There is no jnani, realized man. Jnana, knowledge, alone it is." About the jiva mukta, realized while still living, Bhagavan said, "The jiva mukta is one without any thoughts or sankalpas, inherent tendencies. the thought process ceases completely in him. Some power makes him do things. So he's not the doer, but the one who is made to do.
Sand.
Recollection of Sri Ramana's Jayanti by Diya Sastri. Diya Sastri, the author of this article, is writing for the first time in the mountain path. He is, however, already well known to our readers, being the brother to whom the Dhamma's letters were written. On Friday, the 7th of January 1966, the birthday of Sri Ramana Maharshi will be celebrated at the ashram, when devotees from far and near will assemble to pay homage to the great sage. Mahapurushas of this type are born once in several centuries for the uplift of mankind. Some of them teach the path of Karma Yoga, some the path of Bhakti Yoga, and some the path of Jnana Yoga. Bhagavan belongs to the last category. At birth, everyone enjoys bliss, is the embodiment of Ananda. Very soon thereafter, the pains of hunger make the newborn cry for food. And when that desire is satisfied, the child sleeps soundly and relapses into its original state of bliss. As the child grows, the need for clothing arises, and in due course, for housing also. Thereafter, desires multiply, and a family grows around. A person thus gets buried in the joys and sorrows of family life, and believe that this mundane world is real, forgetting his original state of bliss. Bhagavan therefore tells everyone to find out who he really is. That is the Vichara Marga, the path of self-inquiry, which he taught to people who approached him for enlightenment. He maintained that that path was very easy. He used to tell the devotees, first find out who you are. You were originally, at the time of birth, the embodiment of bliss. You have subsequently built around you this samsara family and have created for yourself a world of continuous and unending sorrow and misery. If you give up the feeling of ego, this family, this world, and the like, and realize that yourself is unconnected with the rest, you will then attain moksha, freedom from bondage. If this path, call it Vichara Marga, that is self-inquiry, or Jnana Marga, that is path of knowledge, is so very easy, one may well ask why people do not take to it in mass. The path is perhaps easy to understand, but extremely difficult to follow. What every person wants is enough food and clothing and a roof to live under. If, however, all these necessities of life are provided and one is asked to live all alone, will one do so? No. One cannot do so for the simple reason that man is a social animal and desires grow in abundance wherever one may happen to live. The greatest punishment in jail life is said to be solitary confinement. A lot of controversy about that now. in the news.
They're thinking they shouldn't do it.
Yeah. Every person has desires, and those grow in proportion to their fulfillment. And there's no limit to them. With desires, sorrows come. Just as there is no end to desires, there's no end to sorrows. That is why ancients have said, Kalpina Vantaha, Kalu Bhagya Vantaha. He who owns only a loincloth is really the richest. Hence it is the sannyasi is enjoined to have only Karatala Bhiksha, Tarutala Vasaha. That is, eat only as much of the two palms of his hands can hold, and living under the shade of trees. The sannyasi is expected to be absorbed at all times in his self. That is called Satchit Ananda, that is Brahman. Bhagavan instructed all who approached him to pursue the inquiry, who am I? With the assurance that whoever does so successfully will realize the truth ultimately. No one can say how many understood this great truth or believed in the path of self-inquiry, but this much is certain, that the lives of countless people have been revolutionized by their contact with Bhagavan, and their minds have consequently been turned towards God. That is what Mahapurushas do when they are born in this world. These birthday celebrations are intended mainly to remind us of those great souls so that we could follow their example and precepts to the best of our abilities. He was a bank manager. Well, I met him. He took us around to my visiting lodge. No Further Change by Professor G. V. Subbaramaya. Questions as to what changes he underwent after coming to Arunachala, Bhagavan replied, I am ever the same. There is neither sankalpa, will, nor change in me. Till I reach the mango grove, I remain indifferent with my eyes shut. Afterwards, I open my eyes and begin functioning actively. Otherwise, there is no change whatsoever in me. But, Bhagavan, said one, we do note many outward changes in you. Yes, replied Bhagavan, that is because you see me as this body. So long as you identify yourself with your body, you cannot but see me as an embodied being. Devotee, do a person's actions in this life affect him in future births? Bhagavan, are you born now? Why do you think of future births? The truth is that there is neither birth nor death. Let him who is born think of death and palliatives for it. Easy Yet Difficult by G.L.N. This is a brief account of how my contact with Sri Ramana helped me. Truth transcends individuality. What I depict is my limited personal understanding of him. My contact with him began in 1930. It was by divine providence, not by my planning, that I was able to spend a continuous period of 3 years at Sri Ramanashram. It was a great blessing. I was a science graduate. I had learned about the atomic structure of the universe, and how matter finally resolves into energy. And the mind also is a form of energy. So, the entire world of mind and matter, when traced to its source, is one uniform energy, or God, or whatever you choose to call it. This was my attitude of mind when I first went to Sri Ramanashrama. Bhagavan was then translating his Uladu Narapadu, 40 verses, into Telugu at the request of Yogi Ramaya. After finishing it, he threw the book to me and said, "You are an Andhra. See if there are any mistakes of grammar in it." This was an act of grace, for it was that translation which was responsible for turning my mind inwards and setting it on the right path. The essence of what Bhagavan said to me in my talk with him was, "You say that on final analysis, all that I see or think or do is one. But that really compromises two notions. The all that is seen and the I that does the seeing, thinking and doing, and says I. Which of these two is more real, true and important? Obviously the seer, since the seeing is dependent on it. So turn your attention to the seer, who is the source of your I, and realize that. This is the real task. Up to now you have been studying the object, not the subject. Now find out for what reality this word I stands. Find the entity which is the source of the expression I. This is the self of all selves." This direct simple teaching was like a tonic to me. It swept away the unrest and confusion that till then had haunted my mind. It is, of course, the essence of Uladu Narapadu, the 40 verses, and the central theme of all Bhagavan's writings. The simplicity of it made me burst out, "Then, Bhagavan, self-realization is very easy, just as you say in the poem, Atma Vidya." Bhagavan smiled and said, "Yes, yes, it seems so at first, but there is difficulty too. You have to overcome your present false values and wrong identification. Therefore, the quest requires concentrated effort and steadfast abidance in the source when this is reached." However, even while warning me, he also added words of solace, "But don't let that deter you. The rise of the urge to seek for the I is itself an act of divine grace. Once this urge gets hold of you, you are in its clutches. The grip of divine grace never relaxes and finally devours you, just as the prey in a tiger's jaws is never allowed to escape." Janaki Mata. It has become our custom to publish in each issue an article about some saint, mystic, or guru. We have decided that in an issue devoted entirely to Sri Bhagavan, this would not be quite appropriate. But just before it was time to go to the press, we received chapters of a still unpublished life of the woman ecstatic Janaki Mata, who has a considerable following and at the same time is a wholehearted devotee of Sri Bhagavan. So we decided to construct an article by stringing together extracts from this.
"She is to take all her followers to Thirunamalai.
Bhagavan, yeah. Arpana's father.
Aparna, Komal.
Komal's mother is a big devotee.
Yeah, and this one in Toronto, what's her name? Sudha.
Sudha's mother went with Janaki Mata to Ramanashram in the last few months of Bhagavan's life.
Yeah.
Yeah, Michael Heiberg.
Do we know her by any other name, Janaki Mata?
No, her name was Janaki only. So,
while occupying herself all day long with household work, Mata sought God by adoration. So self-surrender and intense devotion and prayed for the mysterious divine force to guide every step of hers. From the moment she first came to Bhagavan Sri Ramana, he was her all. For her, Bhagavan Ramana represented the confluence of manifold manifestations of the pantheon. The pace of progress was accelerated thenceforth. The daily puja took a different turn. Names and forms lost their significance. Instead of doing puja to a particular deity, she used to worship whatever manifestation of the formless presented itself at the moment. Once it would be Krishna, and the next instant Shiva. And then all forms ended by merging into the Paramatma, the all-pervading spirit. One thing was clear to her, that the formless God, assuming one form or another for a brief time and finally withdrawing into the endless tract of the void and becoming the cosmic self, would not be of much help to her for practical guidance, and that the one guide on whom she could depend was Bhagavan Ramana. Quote, "There's only one thing worth achieving," she decided. "The root cause of the universe, the one without a second, I must attain it, realize it, and experience it with Bhagavan's grace." She decided that her duty to the family was over, and she could seek the goal as a celibate or recluse. Doctor, her husband, assured her of his wholehearted cooperation. Quote, "Though you are still in the family, you may live as though in an ashram," he said. Mata was physically and mentally exhausted by her experiences, so Doctor took her to Sri Ramanashrama. Sitting among the other devotees in the hall, there in the evening, she reflected with a heavy heart that there was only half an hour till the evening chanting started, and then she would have to leave, as they had to go back home the next day. It was said that without the guidance of a guru, an aspirant could fall into mental disorder, and Bhagavan, who was God to her, was reported to have said that he was not a guru and had no disciples. What was she to do? How could she find an occasion to speak with him alone and ask him? Probably in response to her thoughts, Bhagavan suddenly got up from the couch and went out of the hall, contrary to his daily routine. Considering this a gesture of the grace of the Lord, Sri Mata also went out. Everyone else remained seated. After waiting for a while, Mata saw him returning from the side of the cowshed and hastened to meet him. Coming to him, she prostrated herself at his holy feet in obeisance, with tears of joy trickling down her cheeks. The attendant ordered her roughly to get up and not obstruct Bhagavan's path, but Bhagavan told him curtly to stand aside. Mataji quickly poured out her heart before him, telling him of her spiritual experiences and beseeching him for protection and removal of the obstacles in her quest for liberation. She mentioned also her fear of becoming deranged through having no guru to guide her on the quest. Bhagavan, whose compassion was infinite, replied, "Who told you that you have no guru? I am here as your guru. Nothing will upset your mind." On the night of October 12, 1937, when all around her were asleep, Janaki Mata felt what seemed to her like a powerful explosion in the back of her head. She leapt up from bed, unable to bear the strain. There was a flare-up along her spinal cord from the Muladhara at the base of the spine right up to the Sahasrara in the brain. She saw a brilliance of light like lightning all along the Sushumna between these two points. There was a sort of conflagration followed by flames, some blue and some like lightning, ascending from the Muladhara to the Sahasrara with a hissing sound like that of an angry serpent. It even tried to burst open the top of her skull. And she had the impression that the force was trying to escape into the ether beyond. She did not think her physical body would stand it. She woke up the others who were sleeping nearby and climbed up to the open terrace on the roof. She did not want to die there, as she was only a guest. So she prayed that her body should last at least till she reached home, or the doctor would be terribly upset. Still, the strain did not stop, but continued as violent as before. She turned then to the light in her head and said to it, "If you are going to leave the body, do so unencumbered by wants, desires, and worries, so as not to get tossed into another womb for another reincarnation. But if you are not quite sure of liberation, wait till I am in the holy presence of my Sadhguru, Bhagavan Sri Ramana." On being thus addressed, the mysterious force gave up its efforts to burst open the skull. Its activities within the body continued, but became bearable and much less unpleasant. The body seemed to be disabled. She could neither lie down nor sit, but had to recline against a pile of cushions. Both inwardly and outside her, brilliant and mysterious scenes ablaze with luminosity rushed past, including figures of the gods. The light inside, with the effulgence of 100,000 suns, kept rushing up with rocket speed and dashing against the skull. It carried in it a galaxy of all the deities she had worshipped at various times till then. Next day, Sri Mata was taken home to Kudalore. There she was bedridden and continued to have a series of spiritual experiences. Each time the kundalini shot up, there was purging of the bowels. It seemed as if she was purging away the dross of a multitude of previous births. The thirsty kundalini had eaten away the flesh of her body and consumed half her blood. Solid food was out of the question. She could take only an ounce or two of liquid food per day. This state of affairs continued for 26 days. She bore the ordeal with exemplary patience. Supernatural powers began to manifest in her. While lying in bed one day, her body began to rise slowly in the air, retaining its horizontal position, until it was floating in midair several feet above the bed. Her daughter's mother-in-law, who was lying in the next bed, cried out, asking her what was the matter. She replied, "I'm not interested in acquiring or exhibiting supernatural powers. Let them not manifest in me." On this, the body slowly came down again to the bed. The saying of Sri Ramakrishna that if such a state continued for more than 27 days, the body would collapse, unable to bear the strain, flashed through her mind. It had already lasted 26 days. Oh, one more day. She explained this to doctor and begged him to take her to Bhagavan. He was reluctant at first, owing to her great weakness, but allowed himself to be persuaded. Bhagavan cast a gracious glance upon her and bade her be without fear. Without even touching her, he injected a current of divine strength into her. It was like transmitting electric current from a generator. Next day, she took leave of Bhagavan and returned to Kudalore in her normal state. The wonderful experience Sri Mata had suffered stiffened her body and benumbed her physical faculties. The Sahasrara and the crown of the head was illumined by a radiant and delightful light. She was in a state of grandeur which cannot be put in words. Even the most eloquent description would fail to do justice to that grand and lofty state. The feeling of delight and tranquility suppresses all imagination. All the pleasures of the physical world pale into insignificance when compared to that eternal quietude. Nevertheless, the Kundalini still continued trying to break through the Sahasrara and continue her journey beyond the physical body. Srimata cried out aloud, "What are you trying to do? I and Bhagavan Sri Ramana are inseparable. Against the downpour of the Guru's grace, you can do me no harm." Footnote. This bursting of the Kundalini through the crown of the head is not necessarily fatal or even injurious. It is, in fact, the normal process as described by Una Mule in her article, An Experience of Kundalini, in our issue of April 1965. It can be dangerous if the aspirant is not right for it. The Kundalini path or process in general can be dangerous if not guided by Guru. On this, the force in her desisted from its attempts and her body recovered its subtle suppleness and sense of feeling. After this experience, she told Doctor that she had last attained her long cherished goal and been set free from the round of birth and death. So the purpose of her earthly life was fulfilled. It was 3 days before Doctor could join Sri Mata at Ramanashrama. When he did, he found her completely changed. She had a detached mind and the freedom of a parrot that has escaped from the cage into the open expanse of the sky. Just as its joy and freedom prevents it returning again to its cage, so Sri Mata was not in a mood to get entangled in family life again. The doctor spent a sleepless night. He had undergone the grief of separation at the death of his first wife. Now his second wife was lost to him, even though still alive. He was brooding. Have I not given her all my love and affection? Have I not sacrificed my personal desires to hers, though I had the authority to exercise my rights? Have I not done everything conducive to the attainment of her goal? I have given her all the comforts of a happy life. Why is she indifferent to me now? It grieved him to leave her at the ashram without even any money. But she told him that her inner voice was commanding her to be a sannyasini. And as that mode of life suited her taste, she would adopt it and remain at the ashram for the rest of her life. The doctor and their children were stricken with grief, but their appeals and even their tears had no effect. Doctor wrote to his various relatives telling them that Sri Mata was lost to the family. He decided to leave an aunt for a month to see to her welfare and return home to Kakinada with the children next day. Next morning, however, while she was sitting in front of Bhagavan, the thought flashed through her mind that she had promised him to remain in the family for 5 more years. She therefore immediately said that she would go back with Doctor to Kakinada. Bhagavan gazed steadily at her and then said, "Did I ask you to become a sannyasini? Look at me. I have not taken sannyas and do not wear the ochre robe. You have only one family, but I have to shoulder the burden of all the devotees and their families." It dawned on her then that renunciation must be in the heart, and the inner purity is more important than the outer renunciation.
You know about the Indian tennis player, right? Ramanathan Krishnan, his son Ramesh Krishnan. His wife is on tennis.